agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, political and policy analyst, Kristen Matheny. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, long time no here.
Yeah, it's been a while, and it's so great to have you back. And I know there are a number of listeners, when I mentioned that you would be back here today, they were very excited about that. And so I am really looking forward to doing the show with you today.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to be here. It's been a hot minute. It's been kind of a wild year. We were talking about that before the show. But yeah, I'm happy to be back. A lot has changed and a lot to talk about, I guess.
Definitely. And just to let folks know what we are going to be talking about, we're going to be talking about the special counsel that Attorney General Garland announced in the Trump case and Supreme Court's ruling on Donald Trump's tax returns, Joe Biden, the Biden administration, and Saudi Arabia, the possibility for some bipartisan marijuana legislation in the lame duck session. So a whole lot to get to, and we're going to get started on that in just 1 second. Okay, Kristen, so you want to get us started off here today?
Yeah, so our first topic is going to be that special counsel story that you mentioned, just to give everybody an overview. Last Friday, which was November 18th, Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed Special Prosecutor Jack Smith to oversee the investigations related to former President Trump. And to give you a little background there, Jack Smith is formerly chief of the Justice Department's investigation unit, which oversaw public corruption. So this move was said to be in response to recent developments, especially with Trump's announcement that he'll run for president again. The investigations include a couple of different focus points, including Trump's his alleged national security secrets, the retention of national security secrets at Mar-a-Lago, and the alleged efforts to subvert the 2020 election. So this is going to be pretty comprehensive. And then, of course, in response, Republicans have questions about Smith's impartiality. He has a pretty well-documented history of, as I believe Elise Stefanik put it, playing a role in the IRS's targeting of conservative nonprofits during the Obama era. And also, he's got some personal ties to Democrat political donations via his wife. So there's a history there. So, of course, as usual, we have disagreements about his impartiality and whether or not the DOJ is weaponizing this. So that kind of gives us a little bit of background into both sides of this story. That's all I got. That's the background. I'm a little rusty. How'd I do?
Yeah, no, I think really good, especially, you know, on that weaponizing point. It seems to me that mm-hmm. there's basically the only person that could have been appointed to head this investigation where it wouldn't have been weaponizing would be, I don't know, if Garland appointed Donald Trump to investigate this, and he would have said, no, which we're good. So, but I mean, I think Smith fits the mold of almost all of these special prosecutors that we've seen over time. They're people who really have a stellar credentials, are incredibly well regarded by I would say centrists on both sides, but there are always going to be things that you can find or some sort of connections, because even though Smith is an independent, he's not affiliated directly with any party. People have ties and so forth, and or at least inclinations. But I don't think there's any inclination or any clear evidence that I see that he has it out for Trump in any way or Republicans in any way. And I expect that, you know, he's going to do a reasonable job, just like I expect that John Durham was going to do a reasonable job when Attorney General at the time Barr appointed him to look into the FBI's Russia probe. And so, you know, partisans are going to say what partisans are going to say, but to me, this is a solid choice. And I think that the Attorney General did the right thing in appointing a special counsel, because as Garland pointed out in the announcement, hey, Donald Trump has now announced that he's a candidate. And given this, I think it's right for us to have some sort of separation in this investigation. So that's kind of my take on Smith and the appointment of a special counsel in the first place. Well, what do you think about this move?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I think I understand the point of a special counsel. I understand that the point of, you know, finding somebody who is so impartial is important, but I think it's highly, highly, highly unlikely for the reasons you just laid out. I think it's impossible, or I should say nearly impossible, to find somebody with no political ties whatsoever. Do I think that, you know, obviously Merrick Garland, do I think he's going to be choosing somebody who has ties to the Republican Party, somebody who, you know, maybe has a spouse who donated to the Republican Party? Probably not. I mean, I think this is a likely choice. But I think in the grand scheme of things, you know, he's proven himself to be, you know, pretty diligent in terms of, you know, he has a pretty good track record. He was chief of the Justice Department's investigation unit overseeing public corruption. He has the credentials for it. I mean, my thought is when it comes to, you know, what happened at Mar-a-Lago and the retention of those documents and, you know, everything kind of swirling around 2020, I kind of feel like, you know, if you want to investigate, you know, let the chips fall where they may. Let's see what happens. I, like you said, I don't think we're going to find somebody who's entirely impartial. You know, I think if the tables were turned, I think we, you know, you would have heard about it from Democrats. If a Republican attorney general had appointed somebody with, you know, ties to the Republican Party in some form or fashion, a spouse had donated, et cetera, they would have found fault with it. So I'm kind of, to use a millennial term. I think this is going to play out as it plays out, you know, whether or not it's going to blow up in their faces or not, that remains to be seen. But I really don't have too many problems with Jack Smith. He seems pretty good on paper. Let's see what he does. Now, if he does something wrong, I'll be the first to call it out. But, you know, let's see how he does. I don't really see too much evidence that he's going to be impartial either.
I think there's a distinction I'd want to make between having some sort of partisan inclination, which I think it's almost impossible to be in politics, to be even be interested in politics and just say, oh, no, I just follow it. Right. Or, I mean, it's just you have at least some sort of a ideological framework. But I think that there are people who are better or worse at correcting for that ideological framework and being impartial in terms of how the law is applied. And I think that's an important distinction. So I'm not saying that he's unideological, as I don't think any of the special prosecutors or special counsels have been.
You can't have implicit bias.
Right.
You know?
But I think they can recognize that and say, especially when it's about, you know, questions of has law been violated and should there be indictments, I think that they can sort of take into account that sort of bias and kind of correct for that to a certain extent. And some, obviously some people are better or worse. But, you know, something that Ken said on the show last week, and this had just broken when we started to talk about when we started to record, he said it's interesting to him that all the special counsels have been Republicans. And I thought, we didn't know anything about Smith's background at that point. I wasn't sure about that, so I didn't comment, but I went in and did a little bit of digging. So for folks who don't know, the history of the special counsel or special prosecutor, we've actually had a number of them throughout the course of American political history. Actually, there were eight in the post-Civil War, kind of pre-Watergate era. And then in 1978, we have this thing, the Ethics in Government Act, which was passed in the wake of all the Nixon stuff, basically. And that was when Congress actually, in Title VI of that, allowed for the appointment of what they called special prosecutors. That was later called independent counsels. And this independent counsel statute, though, expired in 1999 and hasn't been renewed. And this was Congress setting up these procedures. And so since then, special counsels have been appointed by the Attorney General based on DOJ's internal regulations and guidelines and so forth. And there have been 5 of them. Janet Reno appointed John Danforth to look at Waco, and she was a Democrat. Danforth was Republican. 2003, Bush appointed Patrick Fitzgerald to look into the Valerie Plame affair, and Fitzgerald was kind of an independent sort of guy. Then we had 2017, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein appoints Robert Mueller. 2020, Barr appoints Durham, and now 2022, Garland appoints Smith. And so, I mean, it's been kind of a mix. The three of those five that had clear political inclinations, those were Republicans. There were two kind of more independent. So it's been kind of a mixed bag, essentially. I just kind of wanted to comment on what Ken had said. So Ken wasn't entirely right on that, but I didn't want to say anything last week because I just didn't have the facts in front of me there. So, but you know, getting to your point about the chips falling where they may and how this is going to work out, I guess I wanted to get your thoughts on that as well. Do you think that, or what would you say is the likelihood of a Trump indictment coming out of this?
That's a really good question. Because it's funny because I, for anybody who is new listening, or if you remember when I was on the show regularly, I used to talk about the fact that my husband's an attorney. He's a criminal defense attorney. So this is, I love talking about legal issues, like political legal issues with him, because his take is pretty solid. And, you know, the thing about an indictment, I think Democrats have largely throughout this election cycle, they were dangling that as a carrot. I noticed that a lot, just because I love, you know, my background is working in elections. I do a lot of political ads, and I looked at Democrat political ads to see what they were doing, just, you know, like size up the competition sort of a thing. And I noticed that they were using the possibility of an indictment as this carrot to get voters out to vote and to vote blue. Especially like I live in South Florida. Obviously it didn't work for them here, but I know that they were using it a lot as this carrot. And, you know, the likelihood of an indictment, I think it's possible that there's an indictment for Trump. Will it amount to anything? Will anything come of it? I'm 50-50 on it. I think I lean maybe towards nothing will come of it. I think the Democrats are trying very, very hard to throw everything they possibly can at the wall to ensure that he doesn't run. I think there are a lot of reasons behind that, a lot of reasons and a lot of like deep-seated anger towards Donald Trump and you know, everything that happened. But it's interesting that you asked me that, because I noticed that it was like an election tactic, was that indictment used as a carrot. Could it happen? I think I'm 50-50 on it. I think it could happen. I mean, the investigation, up until now, the investigations haven't led to anything substantial or meaningful. But, you know, I don't like to say never. So, I'm 50-50 on it. With a Republican House, I think it's going to be a little more difficult.
Well, why do you say that? Because it seems to me that on those two issues that you mentioned that Smith has been charged with investigating, one seems fairly, based on the evidence we have, it seems fairly clear to me, or it seems to me, I'll say this, there seems to be a fairly strong case that Donald Trump or the Trump people, whatever, withheld returning of these documents. Now, that's I would say, in the grand scope of things, that's obviously a lot more minor than interfering with the peaceful transfer of power, trying to overturn the democratic process in various states. I think that's obviously the much more serious charge and the much more difficult to prove
for sure
charge. And I think that it doesn't really matter who's in charge in the House or the Senate. I think that Merrick Garland, who I feels like, obviously he's a partisan, but I think he's a fairly straight shooter sort of guy. I think the fact that Barack Obama nominated him for the Supreme Court when he knew he was going to, well, that was back when he thought that maybe he would actually get a hearing, that he needed to find somebody who was kind of middle of the road, but left leaning-ish, as opposed to some kind of a wild partisan who wouldn't have a chance in a Republican Senate. Turns out Garland didn't, but for other reasons. I think Garland thinks there's a case to be made here, and it seems to me there is, but I guess there's a distinction I would make between whether or not Donald Trump is guilty of these things and whether or not it makes sense to go ahead with an indictment for political reasons.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to the House, you know, Republicans regaining control of the House, I was thinking about this last night. You know, a lot of the stories we're talking about today, and mainly like when we get to the marijuana legislation story, I noticed that there's like this sense of urgency behind it. And it's because the House is going to be flipping in January. The Republicans are going to take control and there are going to be other issues on the table. And I think Democrats know that. And now we have this situation where we have a Democrat Senate, we have a Republican House, and we essentially have gridlock, which we've experienced before. And I think that the House is, and I say this as a Republican who's, you know, a lot of times critical of other Republicans, you have a Republican House that's really gunning to ramp up investigations into various very partisan political issues. And I think there's going to be a lot of distraction. And I think it's going to be harder for Democrats. I mean, arguably, there's a lot of like media coverage that favors Democrats. But I think Democrats are going to have a hard time, you know, winning over the court of public opinion like they have in the past with something like this. I think it's going to be harder for them to get airtime. So I think, you know, if I'm trying to remove my politics from it, I think if, you know, that there's a certain window of time that Democrats need to like step on this and get this ball rolling, or else it's just going to kind of amount to nothing.
Yeah, I guess I wonder, too, whether or not this is one of these situations that Donald Trump wins either way. Let's say he's indicted. And I think that it's a strong likelihood he's going to be indicted, at least on the documents charge. And I think he's indicted. He can go to his kind of greatest witch hunt in American history sort of thing and see what they're doing to me. But if he's not, then it's baseless charges. Democrats waste all this time and effort and they can't find anything because I've said all along I'm innocent. I mean, I feel like Donald Trump set up kind of a heads you win, tails or heads I win, tails you lose sort of situation here. What do you think about that politically?
Oh, for sure. You know, if there's one thing now, you know, eventually we'll get to this at some point today, I know. But, you know, my thoughts about Donald Trump have changed somewhat. But, you know, if there's one thing about Donald Trump, it's that he has complete control over the public sort of, you know, he has a lot of supporters still, but a lot of like very, very dedicated, loyal supporters. He does not have the support of the media, but I feel kind of like it goes without saying he lives rent free in the heads of many, both his supporters and his like strongest critics. And whatever he says is going to lead the news that day. And, you know, he's done this very, very well and very effectively in the past. I mean, you know, admittedly, whenever he did this and he talked about witch hunts and things, I kind of rolled my eyes and, you know, looked for policy and facts and data in what he was saying. But, you know, I think he's going to be very, very good at, you know, deflecting. Obviously, he's done that with his tax returns. He's done that for the past, what, 6 years, almost 6 years now, where he's just kind of like kicked the can down the road. And he's, you know, kept this going. And I think he's just going to keep this narrative going. And I think there are a lot of people that will buy right into this narrative because, again, he still has loyal supporters, you know, and it's going to do nothing but anger people on both sides. I think it's going to anger a lot of Democrats who feel like he's just playing politics and he's doing the same thing over again. I think it's going to anger a lot of Republicans. I mean, from just a Republican standpoint, I think it's going to anger a lot of Republicans. You know, who kind of feel like it's time to move on, like me, kind of feel like it's time to move on. You know, he's keeping this in the news. He's living rent free, you know, in their heads. But at the same time, we're just keeping this issue going over and over. And, you know, I think from a political standpoint, will it be effective if he does that? Yeah, I think it'll be effective to some extent. It'll certainly get him airtime and it'll certainly allow him to, you know, control you know, the top news story every single day that he says it, you know, which you know, gets him a lot of free publicity.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, let's say I was thinking of a scenario and say, let's the kind of progressive left sort of perfect scenario here, right? Donald Trump is indicted and convicted on all charges against him related to the not just the documents, but also the attempts to subvert the election. Now, even if that were to happen before November of 2024, which seems very unlikely, given all the ways these things can be delayed.
I agree. I don't think it's going to happen.
But even then, there's nothing that prevents Donald Trump from running as a candidate and winning. And can you imagine the visuals there? Donald Trump speaking from his prison cell sort of thing. And oh my God, look at what they talk about. I mean, because right, Donald Trump is this fascinating combination of tough guy and victim, and he does that so well. I know that a lot of both the mainstream media and a lot of the Republican establishment, and certainly your governor, Ron DeSantis, are sort of hoping this is the beginning of the end and the whole winter aura is falling away and Donald Trump will just kind of go away. I am skeptical. I am highly skeptical of that, but until I see proof otherwise, I think once again that the support, the fervency, and the depth of the support of Donald Trump is being underestimated by people engaged in a lot of wishful thinking on both the right and the left, and they're going to come to see that. I hope I'm wrong about that, but that's my take anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's why there are a lot of prominent Republicans that have a lot of, you know, more mainstream Republican support. A lot of them are kind of staying quiet right now. They're keeping their heads down. They're not making waves. You know, a lot of them just, you know, battled it out for, you know, election victory. So they're, you know, they're dealing with that. And, you know, there's in some cases there's a transition. In some cases, you know, they're kind of like assembling their administrations. Like in the case, I'm thinking of, you know, Governor Ron DeSantis, who personally, I'm a big fan of Ron DeSantis. But, you know, I think they're, you know, trying to figure out where they're going to go policy wise in the next term. And they're trying to figure out what they're working with in terms of state houses. Like in his case, you know, in the case of a governor, you know, a state house and a state Senate. And largely people like Governor Ron DeSantis, they're staying pretty quiet. I mean, the only person in the last few weeks that's really said anything regarding a potential presidential run is Nikki Haley, you know, on the Republican side. She's the only one that's come out and said anything, which I find very interesting. But, you know, I guess I'm not surprised by it. But at the same time, I'm noticing that they're staying quiet. And I think they're staying quiet because they want to see what Donald Trump does. Because, again, we used to talk about this all the time when he was president, you know, Mike, but if there's one thing we can predict that he's unpredictable. And at any time, you know, he could say anything, he could do anything, you know, and so I think they're waiting to see exactly what's going to happen. They're waiting to see how all of this goes, you know, if it's going to take its toll on him. Although I knew, it's funny because I used to get into these like fervent debates with other Republicans who were saying he's not going to run. And I'm like, he's going to run whether I want him to or you want him to or you don't want him to. He will run because to him, this is a personal vendetta. At this point, and that's what's fueling him.
And clearly, the rules don't apply. I mean, just this week, right? He's at a meal with Kanye West and some
Nick Fuentes.
The Holocaust denier guy. And you would think in the world that we used to know that would be an awful thing for a politician. But you know, that's Donald Trump has his own rules and has established his own rule book. And until I am proven wrong, I am going to assume that Donald Trump will win the Republican nomination and will come very close to, if not win, the 2024 presidential election. That's my prediction. It's been my prediction for years, for the last few years now, and I'm sticking with it.
Yeah, I agree. As much as I would like to see us move in a different direction very, very, very fervently, and I will work for, you know, moving the party along in that direction very, very hard, and I'll put my hat back in the ring there. You know, I think that, you know, Donald Trump, there's still, like you said, you can't underestimate the power, the gravitas he has within the party. you know, the level of support that he has with a lot of Republicans. And, you know, people are pretty upset right now with the Biden administration. There's a lot going on there. You know, a lot has happened in the last year since we've spoken.
Definitely.
So it's, you know, there's a lot of anti-Biden and just anti-Democrat sentiment, you know, that was some of it was reflected, like in the state of Florida here. Some of it was reflected a few weeks ago. But I think, you know, the midterms were in some ways misleading. You know, I think that he probably will take the nomination. I think I'll go that far. I'll say I predict that he gets the nomination for the Republican Party. We'll see if he wins. But there is a lot of, you know, sentiment, and never underestimate his power to control that media narrative, because he will.
Yep, absolutely.
He will. Yeah.
So let's take just a quick break. Then we'll come right back to speaking of controlling the media narrative of one more Donald Trump story in just 1 second. Okay, Kristen, so as I said, we have another Donald Trump story, right, to follow up here.
Yes, and I alluded to it. We were talking about it a little bit with the last story, but it's a nice little segue. This is the story, the ongoing saga of Trump's tax returns. This past Tuesday, the Supreme Court ended a very long time back and forth dispute over whether Congress should have access to former President Donald Trump's tax returns. This has been going on since, like, what, 2016?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
The returns will be obtained by the House Ways and Means Committee. And this is after Trump denied access to his tax information almost 6 years ago at this point. At the time, he was saying it was due to the fact that he was dealing with an ongoing audit. But of course, this doesn't really hold water anymore. While Democrats are hailing this as a victory, there are a lot of critics on both the right and the left who are saying that this is what's been labeled a hollow victory. So the control of the House is shifting in January. This is a little more of a political issue than the previous issue we talked about. And time is ticking. There's only kind of this limited amount of time to actually do something about it before the focus moves to something else. So it's kind of, I read, on MSNBC, I always try to look at, like, you know, left-leaning sources, right-leaning sources. And I was reading an op-ed on MSNBC who said that Democrats won the battle, but Trump won the war, so to speak. So it's kind of interesting. He's been able to fend this off for as long as he has. What say you?
Yeah, you know, I thought Donald Trump's response was a typical sort of Trumpian kind of response, right? He said, the Supreme Court, they always rule against me. Oh, yeah, I was a horrific victim. But, and then he said, it's unprecedented to be handing over tax returns. And I thought, well, you know, I guess to be forced to hand them over, yeah, but every other presidential candidate's done it. And then he said it creates a terrible precedent for future presidents. And then I thought, well, seems like everyone else has just kind of done this as a matter of course. And then, of course, he mentioned Hunter Biden, and we're going to be hearing a lot about Hunter Biden and Hunter mm-hmm. Biden's laptop and all that. But I guess, yeah, I feel like this is something that doesn't, well, I don't know if it ever would have mattered. Actually,
I agree,
because, well, Donald, I mean, from the beginning, Donald Trump has decided that he didn't want to turn over his tax returns. And like you said, he gave that kind of disingenuous, well, I'm being audited response. A lot of people might not actually know that at least once you are president, the IRS automatically audits every sitting president's tax return every year. How it works is that the returns aren't seen by the IRS commissioner because that person is a political appointee. So the sitting president's returns go to someone called the deputy commissioner for services and enforcement. And he or she is the top level civil service career official. And they give it to staff people, and they have to have security clearances to look at that, understandably, that sort of thing. And so this is kind of a standard practice. And what the House Ways and Means Committee is saying is that, well, we want to, their argument is that their legislative purpose for looking at, for wanting President Trump or Donald Trump's returns is that we need to see whether or not we need to change this IRS process in some way, basically. And that's what the courts have pretty much said. I mean, there's a law on the books that says very clearly, passed in 1924, that either the House Ways and Means Committee or the Senate Finance Committee can get the tax returns of any individual taxpayer. And I mean, it's very, that's why the courts have been unanimous in saying, yeah, they're entitled to this. And so while Trump clearly loses on the law, in the end, that's what I say, it doesn't really matter, because nothing that would come out of Donald Trump's tax returns is going to, I don't think, change anyone's minds either way. So politically, it doesn't matter. Legally, I don't see how it matters. I don't buy the whole, well, we are doing this to potentially change how the IRS deals with presidential tax returns. I mean, come on. So, yeah, I don't think it's that big of a deal. And I think you're right that Trump in delaying this for so long is just sort of that, I mean, won the war. At least it's very much a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah. I think there is a lot of speculation, and I think it's very interesting that the timing of this. The Democrats only have now, it's like a couple of weeks to try to turn this around and try to publish some findings and get something out. And they very well could. I mean, they very well could publish something. Well, I don't know if they will, but they could. But I think a lot of people agree that this, you know, that there's some fishing going on there. This is a bit of a fishing expedition to try to find something, you know, unsavory going on in his tax records. And maybe if this had happened a couple of years ago, maybe it would have happened. Maybe it would have been nothing, as a lot of things have been, where it's just kind of. But I think ultimately the political importance here is exactly as you put it. You put it so well, is that it's not going to move the ticker in either direction. I think people who support Donald Trump are going to support Donald Trump no matter what. People who hate Donald Trump, who dislike him, who don't want to see him run for office at all, you know, on both sides, aren't going to be swayed in any direction. And I think this is just going to end up in kind of another.
Because so. if Donald Trump is, or anyone is cheating on their taxes, well, then that's what audits are for. And if the audit had caught that and that had been, well, okay, that's one thing, but that's not, no one's alleging that no one's alleging that this audit process is somehow wrong or corrupt or anything like that. It seems to me like a pretty rigorous, nonpartisan type of process. And there are some people who are saying, well, maybe what we should do is have legislation that requires major party candidates, sitting presidents, to release returns. And in fact, that was part of H.R. 1, that was that For the People Act that the Democratic House passed, that had a little bit of everything basically in it. H.R. 1 was a sprawling type of legislation for sure. And, one thing interestingly to me that H.R. 1 didn't have was any sort of a requirement that members of Congress release their tax information. And I don't know how that, given the fact that that legislation had a whole bunch of everything, it was kind of odd to me, Kristen, that they just somehow forgot about including themselves in that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that could work in different ways for Republicans and Democrats if that was included. But, you know, it kind of gives me the same feeling as like when, you know, Congress increases their salary. It's just kind of like, oh. It seems incredibly self-serving, but,
On the salary increasing, I'll say Congress routinely votes to because the salary increase thing was something that's supposed to be automatic. But every year, somebody suggests that they don't take it. And I think that's a horrible idea, because if you underpay members of Congress, and given the jobs, the insane jobs that they have and the incredible demands and what they could be making otherwise, I think if you underpay people in government, they're going to find ways to make money otherwise. And certainly members of Congress do that. But
I do.
Yeah. But to that issue on tax returns, I would not be in, even if it were having members of Congress release their returns. I think that maybe gives me fewer concerns about separation of powers type of issues. But even then, I feel like if the public feels that this is important, then okay. Then, you know, just like most presidential candidates have done, they release their returns voluntarily. And if you want to do that, great. If you don't, Donald Trump has demonstrated that for a lot of people, it doesn't matter. And if it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. To me, it's the same thing like with medical records. Hey, if we want to know exactly what Joe Biden or Donald Trump's physical or cognitive health is, they're certainly free to go to some independent doctor and have tests and have those released. They don't do that, right? They handpick their doctors. And Donald Trump's guy, I remember at that point, was it Ronnie Jackson? Is that the guy?
Who has his own? A representative now.
Okay, yeah. who said, Donald Trump is basically like a 24-year-old triathlete. That's the kind of shape he's in, you know, sort of thing. But, you know, whatever. If people think that's important, hey, they will kind of force the issue and they can use that in their decision-making process. But I'm uncomfortable with basically adding qualifications to office. Let the public decide what's important and what's not and kind of leave it at that, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think this is a place where we are bipartisan.
There you go. Okay. Happens every once in a while. So, you know, I should also point out that certainly the Democratic Senate could, if they wanted to, pick up on this and request the tax returns. And that would be almost a easier process because the Supreme Court's already ruled. I don't think they're going to waste their time doing that. Also, I don't even know if the House will. Well, the House is not supposed to be able to release returns. I believe that would be illegal, but certainly things leak and they could allude to certain elements in the returns in some kind of a report. But boy, that would leave a bad taste in my mouth. And I kind of hope that they just don't do that, I guess.
Well, they have a short amount of time. They have a couple of weeks to try to get something out. But again, like it just seems like, again, this is going to cause a bunch of headaches. It's going to waste everyone's time, you know, for another X amount of days. And I think the Senate is, you know, wise enough hopefully they're wise enough to understand that and that we should move on.
So do you think we can, speaking of moving on, do you think we can move on to a story that does not involve Donald Trump? What do you think?
Yeah, I think we can. I hope we can. So the next story is one that involves some foreign government issues and a decision that was made last week within the Biden administration. So this happened late in the week, and it didn't make a lot of news. It was funny because when you told me about this story, I was kind of like, you know, I saw that, but I really didn't, it didn't pop up on my screen as much as some of these other stories. So I had to go do a little homework on it. But the Biden administration announced that the Saudi Arabian Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has immunity with respect to a lawsuit over the murder of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi, which drew criticism, namely from Khashoggi's former fiance, which I thought was interesting. As a reminder, Khashoggi was killed in October 2018. He was killed brutally by Saudi agents in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. And U.S. intelligence concluded afterwards that the operation had been ordered by Prince Mohammed. So this decision was made on the basis, this legal decision, I mean, was made on the basis of legal custom. Basically, Justice Department attorneys stated in the actual documentation that the doctrine of head of state immunity is well established in customary international law. And so the fallout from this has been a lot more brutal than I thought. The decision has been met with praise and criticism. And the praise, one person who praised this decision of all people was Senator Tom Cotton, who's a pretty stalwart Republican. He agreed with the immunity ruling as part of a longstanding legal custom. So he kind of went back to tradition and custom and said that this was correct. Although a lot of people are citing Biden's infamous, if you remember, the fist bump, which I remember that made more news. I feel like that made more news over the summer. And a lot of people have on both the right and the left, actually have questioned the motivation behind all of this. It's been perceived as a political move. A lot of people are upset about it. A lot of 9/11 victims' families are upset about it. And there are now a lot of questions kind of swirling around again about whether there are more ties between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. And so Republicans and Democrats are both kind of coming out with this, just like they did earlier in the summer with the fist bump. I thought that was interesting. So it's kind of like an extension of everything that happened this summer, which is very, very interesting. But I'm glad you brought up this story. This was one I enjoyed looking into, actually. It was very complex.
Well, you know, it seems to me that while the doctrine of head of state immunity is well established, I don't often say that I agree with Senator Cotton on that. It's a weird phrase to come out. But yeah. I would also say that MBS, as the cool kids call him, is not technically a head of state. I mean, he is the kind of de facto day-to-day leader of Saudi Arabia, but he's not the formal legal head of state. And this head of state immunity also is typically given to the head of government, the foreign minister. I guess I feel like the Biden administration, when Judge Bates asked them whether or not the MBS had immunity, they could have reasonably gone either way. And they chose to say, well, no, he gets this immunity. It wouldn't have been a bizarre, completely strange decision the other way. And not only that, but if they had said he doesn't have immunity, I took a look at the suit that Khashoggi's fiance, the civil suit that she filed, and MBS's attorneys are challenging this suit on multiple grounds. And the head of state immunity thing would not have done away with it. I mean, I think it's very unlikely that this is going to go anywhere, even without the immunity. And not only that, but as a candidate, Joe Biden took a very hard line against MBS for his role in the not just the murder but the torture of Khashoggi. And it seems like there's pretty strong evidence the guy was tortured, beheaded. It was a horrific kind of thing, right? And so, on one level, I find it to be kind of disgusting. It seems like we are kind of the fist bump thing is sort of part and parcel of this, right? We're sucking up, if you will, to be vulgar about to the Saudis. Why? It seems strange, but in a way, it's not. In thinking about this, I feel like we're in a weird situation where we need Saudi Arabia much more than Saudi Arabia needs us. And because of our strategic kind of orientation in the Middle East, I mean, we have to worry about Saudi Arabia saying, you know what, we can kind of move toward China. And in fact, that's what Saudi Arabia's been doing in a pretty significant way, and largely because of moves that MBS has made. I mean, they're big trading partners. Saudi Arabia is China's largest supplier of crude oil. They took something like 27% of all Saudi Arabian oil exports and exports last year. So they have really close ties. And even though Saudi Arabia is the biggest buyer of U.S. arms, it's not like they can't change some of that over to Chinese arms. And so, we need them more than they need us, I think. And so this results in this kind of thing from a human rights perspective. I find it disgusting. But from sort of a geopolitics kind of thing, I get it, though. I wish Joe Biden and the Biden administration had not done this. I think it was the morally wrong thing to do, and it wouldn't have practically mattered a whole lot, especially given the fact that after our begging of Saudi Arabia to help out right with the oil issue, they decided to just go the other way. And so if we just let ourselves be lapdogs, then with no consequences, then I think we kind of deserve what we get in the way.
Yeah, I mean, the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia has been rough for several years now. And we're kind of dealing with a time where there's a lot of strain. You know, Washington, speaking generally, has been upset with, OPEC's decision to cut all of their output, basically. The U.S. is upset, like you said, about that, because obviously, like, they're essentially cutting off their supply. And I get it. Same as you. Again, like, I get why the decision of the Biden administration to, you know, rely on legal precedent and custom, I completely understand it. But at the same time, I'm also disgusted by it, because it seemed like this may have been an opportunity to, you know, hold someone accountable that I think a lot of people agree was probably at some level directly or indirectly accountable. I mean, you know, the intelligence community said that they basically concluded that he ordered that operation, that, you know, that it came from him. But I feel kind of like stuff is it's stalemated right now. And we're kind of dealing with this grudge match between Washington and Riyadh. And, you know, and now we have to deal with this. So I understand why it was done. You know, and I think in a lot of ways, politically, the Biden administration can kind of rest on that. I think it makes for an easy out for them, basically, is to say this is legal precedent. This is, you know, custom. He's a de facto head of state. He's not really the official, you know, elected head of state, but he's sort of this de facto head of state. And so we can kind of pin this on him. It salvages that relationship to some extent. So I kind of lie exactly where you lie. I get it, but it makes me cringe.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, one thing we haven't talked about today, and it makes sense because typically in lame duck congressional sessions, there's not a lot of legislative activity, right? There's at least maybe the prospect for some actual bipartisan legislation in the last few weeks of Congress, right?
Yeah. So this is a really interesting, I have been following this one just because it's interesting. And again, it relates to everything we were talking about with the first two stories about there being a timeline. And, you know, there's been this push to try to, you know, get this legislation passed. So this week, the Senate was really scrambling to put together a bipartisan kind of lame duck deal regarding cannabis legislation. So Democrat and Republican leaders, including the Senate Banking Chair Sherrod Brown, met with Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to talk about something called the Safe Banking Act. And just to kind of go into what's necessary for this to pass. And this is according to Republicans and Democrats. They've determined that they must find a pairing of financial services and criminal justice reform-centered cannabis legislation that will unify Republicans and Democrats. So they have to be able to come together on this legislation. And leaders on both sides must sign off. So the Senate Banking Committee and the House Financial Services Committee must sign off on this. And then to kind of tandem with that, there's something called the HOPE Act, which was introduced by Republican Representative Dave Joyce and Democrat Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, which could create grants for state expungement programs. So effectively, there's some interesting legislation on the table, you know, regarding cannabis reform. And the fallout has been, you know, some Republicans have kind of warmed up to this, all of this legislation. There still seems to be a little bit of gridlock. Many Republicans are saying that the conservative Republicans, I should say that the HOPE Act and the Safe Banking Act go too far. And there are actually progressive Democrats who argue that it doesn't go far enough. So again,
as always,
kind of getting into the same as. Yeah, I know I sound like a broken record, but it's true. I mean, so they're kind of like hustling and rushing to try to put something together that's at least palatable to pass this before January, which, you know, I think this is a good opportunity to kind of go out with a bang.
Yeah, well, yeah. And you know, the Safe Banking Act has, boy, the House keeps on plugging away at this. It's passed the House six separate times. And every time it's been a bipartisan thing. And I think to me, this seems to be, you can understand why it's bipartisan, because it sort of unites a lot of sort of free market folks on the right and maybe more socially liberal folks on the left, because if you shield financial institutions from potential federal prosecution for, you know, providing financial services to these cannabis businesses that are operating legally under the laws of their state or states they work in, that means less reliance on that kind of cash only sort of thing. That makes it a lot safer. It's a crime issue, right? A crime prevention issue. It allows these businesses to expand much more easily. And this is obviously a growing market as we see more and more states legalize, right? $27 billion in legal sales in 2021, based on data from one industry journal. And that's predicted to go well up in the next few years. And so to me, this is kind of a no-brainer type of thing, at least the SAFE Act, I think. And so I wanted to get, before we moved on to the HOPE Act, what do you think about the SAFE Act?
Oh, I also think it's a no brainer. I'm one of the Republicans who would be all for this if I was sitting in one of those seats. Just because I think that to some extent, and I'm looking at this from a practicality point of view, there are so many issues, and you know, my husband's an attorney, and I know how backed up just the legal system locally, you know, the state legal system and also the federal legal system is. We're so backed up as it is. And I think, you know, this is becoming a growing industry. I think also public sentiment, again, it's not the end all be all. We talked about that earlier, but it is worth something. And I think, you know, you have an overwhelming majority of voters who at least support cannabis, you know, cannabis production, cannabis product sales, even, you know, medical marijuana. You have a younger growing population of voters that supports it. So I think it's definitely a place where we can come together again. I think what's going to be tricky with the Safe Banking Act is finding that sweet spot that makes more progressive Democrats happy and also makes conservative Republicans happy. I don't know that you're ever going to get the far factions of either of those groups.
No.
I think you've got a lot of conservative, particularly religious Republicans who are just opposed to this on premise and principle. And I think you have a lot of progressive Democrats who, you know, believe that this doesn't even go far enough and that everything should be legalized. But I think for most of us who are kind of in the middle of those two things, whether we're kind of leaning to the right, like I am, or we're leaning to the left, I think, you know, in my case, as more of a free market Republican, I think this is a really good step forward. And it also kind of clears the path for other issues, you know, in within the legal system to take precedent over this, because I think there's a lot of unnecessary legislation and you know, a lot of unnecessary legal action taken here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the big problems is when you legalize and then you legalize and overregulate and overtax, what that does is it tends to drive a lot into the illegal market. And the illegal pot market is still much bigger, in part because what a lot of states have found is that because they put so many regulations and taxes on it, that it's just the illegal market can still vastly undercut. And so if you legalize and kind of normalize and but then the prices are much higher in the legal market, say, well, what's pot's fine, I'll just buy it from Bob on the corner here. It costs half as much and it's easier. I mean, you set up a really bad situation. So if you're going to legalize, make it so that the legal market can at least come close to competing with the illegal market. I think that's a pretty wise general principle.
Right. And a kind of a tangent issue to this is the issue of consumption of other drugs that a lot of this unregulated black market sort of pot is laced with. You know, we're hearing so much about like the huge fentanyl problem that we have, and problems with prescription drugs. And, you know, I can't even keep up anymore, but you know, all the different, you know, new, you know, man-made drugs that are making they're finding their way into, marijuana sold on the black market. And I think this is a way to, deal with that in an effective way to deal with that. And, you know, if we normalize it, if we make it less of a problem for companies to, you know, create businesses and mass produce marijuana and to sell it without, you know, the possibility of repercussions, legal repercussions, banking, you know, financial repercussions, et cetera, I think, you know, possibly, again, it's not going to make the problem go away by any means, but it'll certainly lessen the impact of that problem, I think.
And, you know, to me, the HOPE Act, too, makes a lot. Now, I love these acronyms, right? Harnessing opportunities by pursuing expungement. Somebody really tried hard on that. But to me, this is like a tiny thing, right? I mean, it's $20 million over 10 years. So it's basically, it's not even pocket lint in the budget, right? And it would only go to states that actually decide they want expungement programs. And it would only help to kind of cover some of their expenses. So to me, this is about as small potatoes gets. And sure, it might help a little bit. And I'm all for it. If a state wants to pursue expungement, great. And if the federal government can help them out a little bit with that, okay, fine. But to me, this is so tiny. It's almost symbolic, you know. And that's why I think it's getting the at least limited amount of bipartisan support that it is. Although I know that anyone on the right has problems probably voting for anything that was introduced by AOC. So there's that, you know.
Yeah, it's funny because I was actually surprised to see her name on this. But, you know, I think, again, like I was reading some of the quotes from different, you know, different leaders in Congress. I think the thing about the HOPE Act that is attractive to a lot of Republicans and why I think they're coming around particularly to this bit of legislation is because it's such a, like you said, small potatoes. It's a very small investment. In the grand scheme of things, you know, is it going to have a huge impact? Probably not, but it will have an impact. And that's why I think a lot of Republicans are warming to this. I think some are warming to the Safe Banking Act, which is, you know, arguably going to have much bigger implications. Yeah. So, I mean, I have hope. I have hope that this will, you know, pass. But again, like time's a ticking here.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
Before other things take precedent. And, you know, I hope that we get some meaningful bipartisan legislation passed here.
Always a nice thing to see happen for sure. So, you know, before we go today, I was saying to Kristen earlier this week, one of the things I really miss about not doing the show with her is that she always has such interesting recommendations. She reads and watches things like, oh, that sounds really, really cool. And so I thought we would end with a recommendation because I am eager to hear what you have for us today, Kristen.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so I wrote down, I've been reading a ton, especially like late at night when I can't go to sleep. And something that I reread it. I think I mentioned a long time ago that I really love Eric Larson. He writes a lot of really great historical nonfiction. He wrote like Devil in the White City, which is really, really good. He wrote Isaac Storm, Dead Wake, Thunderstruck, all excellent. But I've been really into history lately, just kind of like a current interest of mine. And I've been particularly interested in Winston Churchill because my youngest son really loves Winston Churchill. And so I reread his book, The Splendid and the Vile, which is about Churchill's persuasion of President Roosevelt. He was trying to argue with President Roosevelt that Britain and the U.S. should stick together in World War II and that they were like a worthy ally, and just, you know, how hard he worked to maintain that friendship. And it's something that a lot of history books gloss over is that kind of allyship between the U.S. and Britain and how, you know, how actually tense things were between the two nations. And so I just reread that book and it's so good. I mean, just anything by Eric Larson, but that's like that was the last thing I just finished it last weekend again, the second time. Really good. And then the other thing I've been really into, and I know probably a lot of listeners are into this, I've been so hooked on Yellowstone this season. Yeah. It's so good so far. I'm so into that show. I just think it's a beautifully shot show and it's so compelling. I mean, again, and it got political this season because John Dutton became governor of Montana.
I think those are two excellent. That they will Yellowstone. I've been meaning to watch for a while. It's just one of those things where it's been a crazy semester for me, and I haven't gotten to it. But it's definitely on my list. And yeah, Splendid and the Vile sounds great. So I've got a couple of recommendations too. One is actually something that I tried to recommend last week, but I garbled the recommendation so much I went back at post-production and pulled it off because it made no sense. So I don't know. It was a long weekend. But anyway, so I got it right this week. It's a song. And so there's very low barrier to entry here. It's a long song, around 9 minutes and 15 seconds, but totally worth your 9 minutes and 15 seconds. I even have a YouTube link, so it's free. It's a song called Caravan, not the Van Morrison song some people might be familiar with. It's also a very solid song, one of my favorites, but a song, this one is, it's a Duke Ellington song, actually, performed in this case by the drummers, John Wasson. And it's amazing, transformative. The display of drumming virtuosity is just blows my mind. You have to get into it. It takes about, well, 4 minutes or so till you really get to the heart of it. But then it's the sort of thing where I recommend making sure you have a quiet room and a good set of speakers or headphones and some time. And it's just an astonishingly amazing experience, well worth 9 minutes and 15 seconds of your time. So that's my first recommendation. My second one,
I just Googled it. It looks, I'm going to listen to it after we get off.
It is. Wow. Yeah. I was like, my mouth literally kind of fell open at one point, just thinking, how can a human being actually do this? But yeah, my second one, if you have a little more time, recommended to me about a week or two ago, and I totally got sucked in. It's a show called Inside Man. I don't know if you're familiar with this one.
It's so good.
Okay, you know what I'm talking
totally
about.
I agree with this. Yes, I am. It's very good.
Limited series on, I don't know, it's Netflix. I think it's Netflix or whatever, but I'll put the link on. But yeah, Stanley Tucci plays a death row guy who helps to solve a mystery. And it is, I didn't have the time, but I made the time. And okay, now I'm totally backed up because of it, because it's so totally sucked me in. And yeah, amazing. Well worth my time, I guess I will say, so for a longer thing. So there we go. Those are our recommendations. And after we're done, in just a minute here, actually, Kristen and I will be doing our supporters midweek show. And we're going to be talking about perhaps another Supreme Court leak from Justice Alito and what that might mean, the Alaska midterms, why it took so long and what we think about those results, and also that crazy race between not my favorite Republican House member, but certainly always entertaining House member, Lauren Boebert, and she looks like she's going to squeak the victory over in Colorado District there, and what that has to say maybe about our politics, and maybe if we have some time, some listener questions. There are some listeners who had questions specifically for Kristen after all the time she's been away, and so we're going to try to get to as much of that as we can on the Supporters Bonus Show. And if you're not already a supporter, we hope you will consider becoming one, not just for that bonus show, but for there's other good stuff as well, like ad-free versions of everything we do and other various things at various levels. To check it all out, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support us on Venmo. We're at politicsguys, or through PayPal. And all the support links are in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. But sometimes, you know, you might want to get all that, get the midweek show, but you're not financially in a spot where you can support the show. Totally not a problem. A bunch of people are in that position. We're happy to help you out. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will make sure you get the bonus show every single week. And whether you're a supporter or not, what really does help us out is subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on the podcast app you listen on, and sharing episodes on social media. And if you want to get in touch with us, you have a question, comment, gripe, manifesto, whatever you got, and you want to send it to us, email still works, mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you'll find those links in the show notes. And finally, a special thanks, as always, to our fantastic executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.